From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Soundings. I'm Wayne Pond. Soundings now presents two conversations with scholars at the center about themes of lasting philosophical and literary interest, humankind's widely ranging understanding of freedom and responsibility. First, a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center discusses the poetry of John Milton. Second, a scholar in residence at the center will discuss the philosophical problems of freedom, fatalism, and determinism. Irene Samuel is professor of English at Hunter College of the City University of New York. She was president of the Milton Society of America, and she's the author of many works about John Milton, including two books, Plato and Milton and Dante and Milton.
He is a very great poet indeed. Unquestionably the second greatest poet in the English language, the first one being always Shakespeare. But one can say that Milton has certain advantages over Shakespeare. Shakespeare treats of perhaps a greater range of human experience, but I say perhaps for a reason. But Milton places all human experience in a comprehensive context that enables the reader to see the implications of all the varieties of human experience in ways that Shakespeare doesn't always encourage the reader to see what's implied.
Let me ask you this. Does one necessarily have to be a believer, by whatever definition you want to impose on a term like that, to appreciate the religious themes in work such as Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained?
I'm going to say something that will sound extremely paradoxical. I think it may be a great help not to be a believer when one reads Milton.
Why is that?
Because those who come to Milton expecting him simply to versify what they learned in Sunday school are going to find only that and miss most of what Milton says and does in his poems. I would say that Paradise Lost deals with a question much like the one implied in the opening of Rousseau's Social Contract. Man is born free, but everywhere he sees himself in chains. Milton's great question is something like, man is born for happiness, and with all the possibilities of happiness given to him, how is it then that everywhere and invariably he finds himself miserable? That's the question that he couches in the terms of Genesis 1 through 3, which gives him his story. If one doesn't read Paradise Lost sharing Milton's specifically Christian beliefs, that is, belief in an omniscient, omnipotent, omnibenevolent God, belief in man's original sin, belief in the intervention of the Son to provide the vicarious atonement for man's original sin, one has at some points in the poem to do some translating, but not nearly so much as you'd think. Milton's God speaks as the voice of pure reason, the moral law. The Son speaks as the image of that law, embodied in a person who interprets that law to mean that mercy is greater than and includes justice, that compassion is the ultimate expression of the moral law, and this person is completely sanctioned and approved by that voice of reason, that moral law.
Professor Samuel, was it easier for people in Milton's time to read Paradise Lost and understand it than it is for us?
In some ways, no doubt, they wouldn't have been nearly so troubled by the theological terminology and by the story, because they too would have accepted these. They might have missed a good deal, though, that Milton put into the poem. I've had as students in various courses in Milton every range of theological view and opinion, including agnostics, atheists, at least two students of the Muslim faith, all varieties of Judaic training and lack of training, all varieties of Protestantism, and a number of Roman Catholics, some of them in orders, priests, nuns. The only two students I ever had who could not read Milton were one, a Christian Scientist, though I've had other Christian Scientist students who could read Milton and appreciate him, but this one was so appalled by Milton's believing in the fact of evil that she could not go on with him, and I encouraged her to leave. He wasn't for her, I said. The other had been trained in some severe fundamentalist sect, which she had since thrown off. But every time she saw the name God in the text, she thought of this severe old man with a long white beard saying to her, "Don't." She couldn't get beyond that. To her, too, I said, "Milton is not for you. It will be too much of a struggle for you. Give it up." Though I had had great numbers of students trained in equally fundamentalist Christianity who did not have difficulty with him. I think we have the advantage of all the resistance to Milton. We've had to look at him afresh and see what's there. I expect that much of the problem comes from not seeing what's there in the poem. If you look at it without the preconceptions about its being heavily theological, about its focusing on these questions of original sin and the like, if you look at it as, in the old Aristotelian sense, an imitation of a human action, you get very, very much more of what's there, of the significance, the meaning that Milton has poured into this story, these terms. He is concerned to write a poem that will be doctrinal to a nation. But he doesn't mean in simplistic terms of the catechism. He doesn't mean in a handful of cliches. He means profoundly doctrinal that will really have an effect deep, deep in the minds of his readers. Every age is an age of anxieties. Every age is an age of transition. Every age is an age of struggle. We are, of course, more conscious of the anxieties, the transitions, the struggles in our own time. Milton's time was very decidedly an age of anxiety, struggle, transition. Some would say transition to the modern world. Some of those who say that meaning something good, some meaning something not so desirable. Milton would have recognized that the essential choices remain constant. The choice between a kind of petty idea of self-aggrandizement and a recognition that we are part of a universe that we didn't create. That we do best in that universe if we accept its laws as guiding us too, as setting the necessary bounds within which we can make choices. That in fact is the central theme of Paradise Lost, that man is, as God himself says in the poem, created sufficient to stand, though free to fall. Given reason and free will, he has enough to enable him to stand. And to stand, of course, means for Milton to continue in his happiness, the happiness given him at his creation. But I suspect that he would be amused in a way, with a grim kind of ironic amusement, to find that his conception of Satan, for example, had been so brilliantly illustrated by 20th century dictators, as though he had prophetically previewed what a Hitler and a Stalin were going to be and do. His Satan is the embodiment of evil, and Milton had a canny notion of what that evil essentially and inherently was. The dominant need to be the topmost figure in the universe. And Satan's determination that if he's going to go down, then the whole universe is going to go down with him. He can't achieve that, of course. Milton has great confidence in the universe. That's what his belief in God meant to him, a confidence in the universe. And he really believes that humanity will triumph, good will triumph, but he doesn't see it as an easy thing. He knows the difficulties. One of the grimmest lines, phrases in Paradise Lost, comes in Book 12, "Thus shall the world go on to good malignant, to bad men benign, under its own weight groaning." He wouldn't have been surprised by any of the horrors of our 20th century. He knew the worst that the worst could do, and he knew how likely they were at intervals to triumph. He knew also, he felt the confidence that the good man can lead a good life in spite of all that, and that ultimately the universe is on the side of humanity. That conviction sustained him, of course, through the defeat of his own political, ecclesiastical side in the 17th century. It would have sustained him even in our time.
Irene Samuel was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center. She's professor of English at Hunter College of the City University of New York. From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to a program about literary and philosophical conceptions of human freedom and responsibility. My guest now is Alvin Goldman, a scholar at the National Humanities Center who teaches philosophy at the University of Illinois at Chicago Circle. At the center, Professor Goldman is writing a book about the cognitive sciences and the study of social structures of knowledge.
Historically, of course, theological writers were very concerned with this issue and wrote some of the most important early contributions to this debate.
Who, for instance?
Well, St. Augustine is certainly one, and one of the early ones who wrote influentially, and he believed... Well, the problem starts as follows from a theological perspective. On a standard conception of God in the Christian tradition, God is omniscient, knows everything. Okay,
and does that mean that because he knows everything, things are going to happen in a certain way?
Well, that's the inference that seems to be natural, that because God is omniscient, he knows beforehand everything that's going to happen. And if he knows beforehand everything that's going to happen, then it must be necessary that it's going to happen that way. At least that's what a lot of people have been tempted to say. But if it's necessary that it's going to happen a certain way, then a conclusion many people would draw is that people aren't free to make things happen one way rather than a different way.
Sure.
St. Augustine felt that people do have freedom despite the fact that God has foreknowledge.
The fact that he knows it doesn't necessarily make it happen.
That's right. That was precisely the idea. That isn't what makes it happen. It's still human will, human choice, compatibilism or reconciliationism. The idea is that freedom is compatible with determinism. You can have both, or you can reconcile the two. Now, as I say, many contemporary philosophers accept that alternative, but many others say that it doesn't really work, that if actions and choices are determined, then in an important sense, it wasn't possible that you should do otherwise, and if it wasn't possible that you should do otherwise, then you're not really free. And for contemporary philosophers, the question comes down to what's the proper definition of freedom? That is, what do we really mean by being free? What do we think is true of us when we say that we're free? And although it might seem initially that it's perfectly clear what we have in mind by that, upon reflection, it turns out to be not nearly so clear. And since the topic of freedom is, of course, always or long been tied up with the question of responsibility, many people saying nobody's responsible for their actions unless they do them freely, then question of what is a tenable or defensible conception of freedom gets linked up with questions of responsibility and punishment.
How have philosophers approached this disparity or this problem of, are people truly free or are our actions predetermined?
There are three basic positions that have been debated and are still debated and taken seriously by different people. One position is that there is freedom, and that since there's freedom, there can't be determination. So we must not be determined, or we aren't determined. Okay, a second position is there is determinism, and therefore,
we're not
there
free.
Isn't freedom. We're not free. It's an illusion. We seem to be free, but that's not the case. The third position is, and although this may sound paradoxical, it is intended to be not a paradoxical position at all, but a resolution of the issue. And that's the view that both are true,
mm-hmm.
or at any rate, that both can be true, that it could be the case, it can be the case, maybe it is the case, both that we're determined and yet that we really are free. And that's a position which has been taken by many of the most influential philosophers, certainly in the modern period, Locke, Hobbes, Hume, many 20th century philosophers, actually taken earlier by St. Augustine.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, there are many 20th century philosophers, contemporary philosophers, who don't think that works. Now, one thing that I think is important on this topic is to distinguish between fatalism and determinism. Now, it may sound as if they're the same, but I think they really are different and should be distinguished.
Well, what's the difference?
Well, take an example. Suppose you are about to board a train, let's say a train for New York. But you ask yourself, do you really want to go to New York? Do you want to wind up in New York? And you're trying to decide in this matter. Now, a fatalist might say, if he believed that whether or not you were going to get to New York was fated. Let's suppose he said that it was fated that you were going to get to New York. That's a particular instance of being fated.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Such a person might say that in this particular instance, you are fated to wind up in New York. Okay. Now, what would that mean? Well, that would mean that no matter what you do, you're going to wind up in New York. Now, putting it that way, it's not a very plausible view.
Well, it's also sort of malign, isn't it?
Some evil, it sounds as if some evil demon is arranging it. That's
mm-hmm.
right, that's right. But the view of fatalism, I think, not to be at all a plausible view about the way the world really is. Okay. Now, contrast that with determinism. Now, determinism doesn't imply that, say in the train case, you're going to wind up in New York no matter what you do, okay? Determinism wouldn't say, well, if you get off this train and get on a different one instead, you're still going to wind up in New York, okay? Determinism would say that everything that happens as a result of previous events which cause and necessitate the next sequence of events.
So the difference is, with the determinist, you have a long connecting chain of causalities.
The crucial distinction is that a determinist will say such and such will happen because this is what's going to be done beforehand. The determinist doesn't say such and such will happen no matter what might be done in between. See, the fatalist says, no matter what is done now, such and such, the very same thing is going to happen later. Doesn't matter whether you stay on the train or whether you get on a different train or you go home and try to go about your daily business. No matter which of these things happens now,
you're going to get the same result.
You're still going to wind up the same way. Now, a determinist doesn't doesn't have to say that and doesn't in general say that.
I see.
Okay. Now, that's very important for deciding about whether freedom is compatible with, can coexist with, one of these other things, fatalism or determinism.
Al, in one of your books, you use a metaphor, a trope, what you call the book of life, as a way of illustrating some of these difficulties, freedom, responsibility, determinism. Can you tell me about that?
Here's an argument that might be given relevant to whether or not determinism is true or not. The argument would go, in fact, people's behavior can't be predicted. At least it can't be predicted in a way that they can find out about. Because if their behavior, if a prediction is made of their behavior and they learn about it, they certainly are capable
sure.
of doing differently.
Mm-hmm.
They may decide to do what was predicted, but then again, in general, they can decide to do otherwise. So one can't predict their behavior. But, the argument would go, if their behavior can't be predicted, then it isn't determined. Even if we're not determined, it isn't clear that we're free. In fact, some people would say that if we're not determined, that means that our actions must happen capriciously or by chance. And certainly it isn't part of being free that your actions should happen capriciously or by chance.
In other words, freedom implies a sort of a conscientious planning rather than a randomness to life.
That's right. And the idea of indeterminism is one of a certain element of randomness, that things just happen without being lawfully caused by previous events. They're the previous events and they happen, but what happens next is just a matter of chance or randomness.
I see.
Now that would be how indeterminism could be true.
Well, tell me how you use this story of the Book of Life.
Well, I raise the question whether or not, first of all, what the connection is between being determined and being predictable. Now, a lot of philosophers have tied those ideas closely together. Okay, they've said that if determinism is true, then everything is in principle predictable. That there could be a demon, for example, who, if he knew everything about the world in a given point of time, could predict the subsequent states of the world at every time.
This was knowledge is power.
Idea. Huh? Knowledge is at least predictive power.
Yeah.
Now, actually, that's not so clear that if determinism is true, one can make predictions. I think that's more complex than some philosophers have suggested. Still, the issue has to be raised. Well, could there be predictions of people's behavior that always come out true? Now, one way in which this question can arise is in connection with, say, prediction of election results. Some people in the social sciences and philosophers thinking about the social sciences have pointed to the phenomenon of predictions that refute themselves. That, for example, if a pollster announces that before an election that such and such is going to be the result, that Jones will win and that he'll get exactly such and such percent of the vote, then this announcement, this publication by, say, a prestigious pollster, might itself change the decisions of some voters. This idea that a prediction can refute itself, can make things happen differently, raises the question whether it really is possible, as determinism would seem to suggest, that there could be predictions of an individual's life, which that person nonetheless reads and still come true. Now, what I do in this article, which then appeared as a chapter of a book, is say that, well, such cases are possible, and that they're possible even if we assume that the world goes along roughly as it seems to go along as we know the world. And so I concoct a case and describe a case in which somebody, and I don't know who this would be or how the person would proceed, but somebody has written a book of my life. And this book is in a library, and I come across this book, and I sit down and read parts of it with, of course, predictions of what I'm going to do that day or the next day or some later time. And in this story that I describe, though I sometimes decide, at least initially, to refute the book, having read its predictions, nonetheless, in the end, the book turns out to be right. Now, what I suggest is that, first, this story is a story that can be told in a way that fits the way the world that we know, that we're all familiar with. And so that suggests that, as far as we can tell, the world may be determined. We leave aside here quantum physics and the issues that it raises, which seem to go contrary to the idea of full determinism. But the first idea, then, is that as far as the macro world that we're familiar with seems to be, it's compatible with determinism. And yet, secondly, I would go on to say, it's still a world in which there is choice, in which there is, I would say, freedom. So it seems to me that there is a possibility of things happening which would go along with determinism, and yet those things would not belie or be inconsistent with freedom and choice. There would still be genuine choosing of what one does, even though the book will have realized that these choices would be made and written them down. I don't claim for sure that determinism is true, because to make such a claim would say something which only the course of science ultimately can tell us about. But as far as ordinary experience goes, I think determinism isn't ruled out at any rate. And more importantly,
it isn't a malign kind of thing.
That's right. The main question that the philosophers try to deal with in this area is whether, if determinism were true, there could still be free will anyway. Okay, and there I'm inclined to say, yes, there could be free will.
And that's why you see a coexistence rather than a conflict.
Right. That's right. On the other hand, there are plenty of philosophers who disagree with that position.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think at this moment I would have to say that's not the dominant position by any means. So any philosopher taking that view, of course, has to be prepared
to defend
that against other philosophers. But I would nonetheless agree with your suggestion that, yes, I think of it as an optimistic view, that we can have freedom, and what we seem to think is true of ourselves isn't belied by possibility of determinism.
Alvin Goldman is a scholar at the National Humanities Center, where he's writing a book about philosophical epistemology, the cognitive sciences, and social structures of knowledge. You've been listening to Soundings, conversations originating at the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. This is Wayne Pond. The center is interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible, in part, by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California. Listen to Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center with an invitation for you to join me this week for two conversations on freedom and responsibility. From a literary perspective, a John Milton scholar will discuss will, choice, and freedom in poems such as Paradise Lost. And from a philosophical viewpoint, a scholar of moral philosophy offers insights on contemporary notions of freedom, fatalism, and determinism. Join me this week for Soundings.